This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutin, with me, Tan Chung Han, looking dashing as always on, you know, this early in the morning.
All day, every day.
That's friend. Right. I'm not going to mention the fact that you have Kleenex stuffed up to your nostril. Because you do.
I know.
It's disgusting. It's so, I'm so glad you're not in your earlier gig, which is what, television,
TV,
right?
Yeah,
okay. So was the weekend good for you?
It was. It was very eventful. How about yours?
My weekend was good too. I completed reading a graphic novel called The Art of Charlie Chan Hock Chai, the Eisner winner. And, you know, he's a Malaysian born, so we should all claim credit, I guess, as a consequence. And he went on to live in Singapore. And it's brilliant. It's a homage to comics because it's got different styles as well, you know, and the artwork. It's like every page is a bit of art.
And so cultured, like you.
No, I mean, a lot of kids read comics and, you know, I...
Oh, it's a comic book.
It's a comic, yeah, sorry. It's a graphic novel comic book. I mean, the same genre,
okay, well,
right?
So much for that, yeah.
Yeah, but it's, and it's brilliant. It's so beautiful. Okay. Also, just a quick catch up on what happens over the weekend in terms of news. Just following, you know, a bit of global warming news. Farmers in Spain's largest cereal-growing region expect to lose some 60 to 70% of their crop. This is, you know, not unusual, apparently. It's become the new norm for them, drought. It used to be the occasional occurrence. Now it's become the new normal, and it's quite scary.
Yeah, and these crops are apparently specifically catered to growing cereal, right? Like, so I'm guessing like breakfast cereal?
Or yeah, like grain, like, you know, barley and hops. Not
right.
Nobody grows breakfast cereal. I mean there's not muesli
right.
on the crop.
Well, I mean, I don't know. Like cereal growing region. I'm like, well, are these, like, you know, the raw
cereal,
materials for
cereal? Cereal, yeah. Yeah, okay. You know, grain. Okay.
Oh, just, well, then call it grain then. Why is it calling cereal growing region?
Oh, my God, what do we do with you?
I don't know.
See, the CIA says there's no imminent threat of nuclear war with North Korea, but then CIA did not also see the end of the Soviet Union. So, hey, Charlottesville, nothing to hide. Those are two different places on planet Earth where there was violence. I'm going to talk more about that later. The ongoing Taylor Swift, a groping trial. I don't know if you've been following that. The DJ, who's the subject of the suit by Taylor Swift, had his suit against her dismissed. So he's lost round one in the battle. And over the weekend, we also had a raid by the counterterrorism unit in search of IS fighters in no less than Nilai Business Center, some 10 kilometers away from KLIA. That apparently... Nilai 3, that and the developments around there apparently have a lot of people of Afghan and Pakistani origin. Doesn't make them necessarily
right.
terrorists, but, you know, for some reason, and in the lead-up to the SEA Games, the counterterrorism unit has been extra vigilant. They also, I think intelligence suggests that many IS fighters have moved into Malaysia and they're trying to flush them out. We've had several raids of this sort this year already, several.
Right, and there was also news that there were those would-be ISIS or Islamic State fighters who were then deported, right, from Syria, and some of them could have come to Malaysia, right?
So absolutely. Mm. So our counterterrorism unit being ever vigilant there. Mm. We'll be back with more. First, Bill Withers, Heartbreak Road, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Bill Withers and Heartbreak Road. Very mellow song, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's going to get you in the mood as we ramp up to reach octane levels.
By Wednesday? Today, no, by Wednesday.
You think so? I'm giving myself a little more
a steeper
credit
ramp?
For that. Yeah, I think it's going to like get really hot. Come to, you know, our discussion about the Dota team.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Okay. Mm. But first, let's talk about Harry Potter. Because apparently, as a result of this, this blockbuster of a series of books as well as movies, Wild birds, in particular owls, are being sold as pets around the world. And this is apparently, in particular in Asia, where the levels have soared to some
13,000. Yeah. Right. And apparently, each of these birds cost only 10 to 30 US dollars each, which is rather affordable, I guess, relatively speaking. But this kind of phenomenon is not new. If you recall, Sharad, do you remember that Finding Dory movie?
The other fish,
the blue one. Yeah.
Finding Nemo.
No, the second one, Finding Dory. Yeah. Anyways, so with Finding Dory, apparently, there's an article in the New York Post.
You were just speaking to a voiceless friend.
I know.
You?
Yeah. Sorry. I was being corrected by this other voice.
The voiceless producer.
I hear many voices, but nevertheless, even with that Finding Dory movie last year, already there were concerns about how viewers might start going out and getting those, not just the clown fish, but also the blue fish. I don't know what it's called, right? So you have people, fans of these various successful franchises, then acting out and trying to blur the lines between reality and fantasy, really.
Well, that's a lovely impulse, though. I mean, one hand, you know, wanting to kind of really inhabit the world of which you become so attached to or so attracted to. I love that impulse. But then there's also a question of consequence. Now, if the consequences of your actions lead you as a child to do something that's damaging the environment, you think the adults around you might actually suggest that you do otherwise, right? I mean, you're kind of hoping the parents don't merely pander to the impulses of children, that they put a kind of reality check on those impulses. And, I remember even as a child, you know, one of my favorite cartoons was Huckleberry Hound. And, you know, one of the things, Huckleberry Hound, I don't know if you remember, Hanna-Barbera.
I'm Googling this. I remember Hanna-Barbera.
Yeah. Right? So that whole cast of, you know, Yogi Bear and whatever. But one of the things I thought I could do, because Huckleberry Hound could do it, was to ride his scooter up a pole. So I tried to take my tricycle and ride up the side of the wall of the house. And what I did was I tipped over and cracked my head. And I got a couple of stitches for that.
That explains so many things.
It does, doesn't it? But the point is, one expects one's parents to kind of like put a stop to that, saying, well, however cute it might be to want to be like Huckleberry Hound, you're not. And, you know, the world of the cartoon is very different from the world that you inhabit, young man. And you can't do quite what the magical things that are done in, you know, the cartoon.
Right, exactly. And those were the kind of instances I was going to highlight, you know, before you shared your personal cracking story right there. As in, how often have we seen, you know, people just imitate their heroes on screen? It's not something new. You go back to like the Supermans, and then you got a kid who just ties that blanket around his neck and then just jumps off something and, you know, gets hurt, right? Like, we see that and we hear about that all the time. But now, apparently, according to these articles, it now transcends into the animal world as well, whereby they're getting owls and these regal blue tangs. That's the official name for Dory. Yeah.
All right. Okay. So the thing is, you know, and I mentioned the graphic novel by Sunny Liu, The Art of Chan Hok Chai, is that what kids can do quite successfully, it seems, is to take that world of, you know, the world of imagination and make believe and put it into something, into the work they do. And it could be art. In the case of the story of Charlie Chan, is he becomes, you know, he falls in love with this world and wants to become someone who creates such worlds. So he becomes a comic artist. And that, I think, is a really nice way of taking that imaginative world and keeping it in the world of the imagination rather than trying to act it out in the world. Because, an adult wearing a cape and stalking the neighborhood would not be such. It'd be a bit creepy,
okay.
I think.
Well, let's try and find some middle ground here. What about those adults who are, say, are totally obsessed with some fiction fictional character whereby like they dedicate dens in their homes to this, you know, particular character. I'm thinking of like a bat cave of sorts, or you know, those adults who just collect just a ton of memorabilia on Star Wars or Indiana Jones, you know, whatever.
I think that's fine. Yeah, because that's also, well, that's putting your imaginative impulses into things, right? Yeah. Into purchasing things. Right. So, yeah. I mean, that's kind of...
As long as it doesn't hurt another living being.
Don't you think? Yeah.
Be it owls or fishes or human.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or yourself.
So no real consequence except to maybe deplete your, you know, life savings. But
or have your spouse really angry at you.
If you don't take out the wrapper, it might be one of those collectibles, and then in which case you might be able to sell it at some point in time. But who knows? This is The Rolling Stones, Start Me Up, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Rolling Stones with Start Me Up, and I'm started up. How about you, Tan Chung Han?
Yeah, totally started up right now.
Okay.
19 minutes past 6 a.m.
Okay, big news over the weekend. 23-year-old Malaysian Dota player Afu Tiu Sun
Chuan. Why
you
gotta say it that way?
Because it's actually Afu. Afu. Yeah. Okay, Afu. No, actually, it'd be like two words, right? Afu, right? The A Kao, you know, A Cheng or something.
Right,
like.
But apparently...
It's not Afu. Anyway, yeah. The point is that he was involved in the World Cup of Dota and won, and part of a team that won a $2.5 million prize. Now, it's great, and I think we should laud every Malaysian that does well, whether domestically or internationally. They've won, they've achieved something, they've put effort into it. And Dota, though I have no idea how it's even played, but I kind of think it's a game or something. It's kind of a digital game, I guess.
Okay, but
like Counter-Strike.
I sense a but coming up here. But
no, there's no but. Oh. But the issue is, so you think, okay, you win something like this, and you know maybe it will give legitimacy and credence to the activity, right? Because I think perhaps in the minds of some people, prejudiced people like myself, they'll think, oh, this is just a waste of time. A lot of kids spend so much money and time, you know, hanging out at these gaming centers, doing nothing but playing these games. And now you see it turned into something quite quite lucrative, mm-hmm. right? But the question really is this now a professional choice? I mean, can you imagine parents saying, son, have you played your Dota? Have you done your 6 hours of Dota today? You know? I mean, because you know, when you grow up, I want you to be a multi-million dollar player
right.
for Dota.
And I wonder if there'll be a, you know, this kind of market demand for Dota tutors or, like, you know, Dota trainers. You know?
Can imagine a whole ecosystem
exactly,
around
right?
Dota, right?
But... Okay, so judging by this article, apparently you kind of peak as a Dota player in your mid-20s and you kind of have to retire after that. Because this Afu is mm-hmm. not the first Malaysian to be handsomely rewarded due to his or her Dota exploits. You go back to 2012 and we've had several other Malaysians who were part of these international teams who have won as well. Although this year, apparently the prize pool is like the largest in the tournament's history. You know, so whether or not it's a sustainable pursuit, I think there are still many question marks, but it certainly sets you up for life though. I mean, think about it.
You know? If you spend that money wisely, we'll come to that question first, but I do want to note that maybe one of the reasons why there's a kind of shelf life to Dota playing, because you think, well, if you're sitting in a chair, I mean, how physically strenuous can this be, right? Why can't you go on straight into your mid-50s playing Dota? But maybe it's because you have to have a kind of nickname. So some of the famous players include Monet Dupeng, Super Xiao Zun Hao, Inflame He Yongzheng, and DDC Leong Fatmeng from Macau. Now, with names like that, you might not want to carry that into adulthood, right?
I don't know about you. I mean, I was going to say...
You would be DDC. I mean. Okay, but the point, the most serious question is now, if your child is so lucky and so talented that he becomes a big prize-winning Dota player, how would you deal with a young person with that kind of success? Now, this 10 million ringgit that's been dropped into their laps, of course, is being shared by the team members, but it's not a big team.
Five of them.
Yeah, so they're going to get well, if my math serves me right, about 2 million ringgit.
Well done.
Plus.
Pretty good.
Pretty good, right? 2 million apiece. Now, 2 million in your mid-20s can go very, very quickly if you're not careful, couldn't it?
Yeah, but 2 million in your early 20s can really set you up for life as well if you really play your cards right. You know, and I bet you there'd be many...
That's a mixed metaphor, by the way, cards, right?
Okay. I don't know, cards and dota. Okay. Two different vices, maybe, and potentially lucrative as well. But I bet you there have been many, many discussions, let's just put it that way, between teens and their parents, where the teen then uses these kind of stories, you know, throws it into their parents' face and says, see, it's not a waste of time, it can make me a multimillionaire. But the question here is about the, it's all down to statistics, right? You know, what are the chances of you, out of the millions and millions of kids out there playing Dota, what are the chances of you actually winning this Dota tournament?
Well, what about tennis? What about all the other athletic pursuits and, you know, that could turn professional,
right?
And you know, even piano playing and musical instruments, right? You could, you know, you could invest a lot in your child in, say, guitar lessons, and one day they become a superstar. They, you know, they become a Taylor Swift or something like that. But of course, again, the question is, you know, the law of averages. I mean, what are the chances, right?
Right.
So should you then, for that reason alone, not invest in these things?
All right, so at the risk.
Is there a value in it? And I don't know enough about Dota, but maybe there are some really you know, important mental skills that you develop as playing, you know, mental agility.
Maybe.
You know, manual dexterity, moving those fingers across the keyboard. I don't know if keyboards are being used, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Ah, so there it is. So but, manual dexterity.
Okay, yeah, great. But then as opposed to, say, you know, tennis, even if you don't make it, there are other, you know, tremendous benefits as well, you know, actual physical exercise, you know, plenty more, I mean, tremendously more movement compared to, say, Dota players, right? So now, while the chances of you becoming a millionaire via Dota, yeah, you know, there is that chance, but if you don't, then what you gain out of it?
Okay. If you're a parent or you're a kid, tell us what you think about Dota. You can tweet us at BFM Radio, or you can even WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. And tell us what you think about Dota as a professional option for you. We'll be back shortly. This is Jeff Buckley. Last goodbye. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. That was the Beach Boys with Good Vibrations. I'm Sharad Kutin, with me, Tan Chung Han. Time to talk about some bad vibes. Some bad vibrations are coming out of a little place in the U.S. Called Charlottesville, which sounds like it'd be full of white picket fences and lots of polite and, you know, well-turned-out individuals. Mm. But it was also over the weekend the site of a headline-grabbing event that involved the so-called alternative right or alt-right. In many incarnations over the years, the Ku Klux Klan, who, you know, often dress in bedsheets and burn crosses, and lynch African-American men and women. Well, mostly men, I think, is the was the tradition. Han, you spent some time in the U.S., and I understand from conversations, deep personal conversations with you, that you spent time very close to Charlottesville.
And that's right. So I went to college less than an hour outside of Charlottesville. Now, Charlottesville is the home of University of Virginia. In fact, my sister is actually working for the University of Virginia. So I just checked in with her. You know, she's fine. Now, Charlottesville, besides being the home of UVA, is also a very liberal town. And so the reason fueling the protests over the weekend from the alt-right and also the counter-protest stems from the decision to rid Charlottesville of you know, some mementos or statues from its Confederate past, specifically a statue of Robert E. Lee, a Civil War leader. Yeah.
Yeah, he was a general with the Confederate Army. Sorry, if you don't know your American history, and you wouldn't be faulted for that, the Confederates, of course, were the South, basically wanting to hold on to slavery as a system, though it's actually a much more complicated story.
Right.
But the point is, this might not have, you know, achieved any kind of, you know, global interest if not for what's been happening in the U.S., you know, over the years, including the Obama administration, but more so kind of intensified with the win of Donald Trump, which is the rise of white supremacists and the almost legitimization of the kind of racist speech that comes from that segment of the political spectrum. Mm. And you know, I've just looked up some quick statistics. Up 250 African-American men were killed in police violence last year. And so I'm not even counting the numbers here. But, you know, the kind of racialized violence in America, very, very intense, you know, almost epidemic in proportions. If we talked about other countries, we would all be kind of like highlighting this. But in the U.S., it seems to become the new norm, I think.
Well, yeah, I mean, I wonder how much you can infer about, you know, what's actually happening on the ground just based on headlines, right? Because if people were to do the same about Malaysia, all they'll know about us is missing planes and, you know...
Missing money.
Yeah, missing money. Right, exactly. There we go. Right? So now, I spent over 7 or almost 8 years in the American South. Okay, North Carolina, Virginia, Florida. Experienced significantly fewer instances of racism, actually barely anything that I can remember, versus my 1 year in Sydney. Okay, you know, just to set the context that, in fact, it wasn't uncommon to actually see a lot of Confederate flags flying around, but many of the people I encountered were actually more of the liberal side of that political movement, I guess. You know, while on one hand they want to retain like the identity of the South, but then they contend it's not about racism or slavery anymore. It's moved beyond that, but it's about, you know, having this proud Southern gentleman identity and whatnot. So they actually brought me to rodeos and taught me to shoot guns and whatnot. Right? So you have that kind of movement. Obviously, with alt-right, as evidenced by the comments from the Virginia governor, these are people who basically crawled out of the woodwork, right? These scum, if I can call them that, right? They're crawling out from all
this place
and then converge upon Charlottesville because of the decision to remove that statue.
Yeah. Right, so one of the slogans is, we will not be replaced, which is interesting because here you have a majority, a demographic majority, right? And people purporting to represent that demographic majority, fearing being swamped by others, right? Mm. So, of course, you know, historically, African-Americans have been subject to huge amounts of violence from the white majority in all kinds of ways. In fact, I believe you stayed in a little town called Lynchburg, which, of course, is...
Lynchburg, yep.
It makes reference to, I don't know if it actually does, but because it reminds us of the infamous lynchings, meaning you basically go out, find an African-American man, and you string them up and to death, basically, is what happens, right? But that aside, there is this really troubling question of political leadership or the lack of political leadership in this question, right? So what's also been making the headlines is the White House and Donald Trump's response to this. In fact, we had a recent bombing of a mosque in the U.S. The governor of that state came out and said it was domestic terrorism. Very strong words against those who attack Muslims in America. But the White House said nothing. Mm. And in this instance, the White House kind of like finessed its message by suggesting there was violence on both sides. Because we know that, and this is one of the headlines, is that somebody has died as a consequence. A woman has died.
Right.
And she was protesting the alternative right.
Well, to be fair, the White House has issued a statement on the incident. And
yes, I didn't say they didn't. What I said was they made it sound like the violence was on both sides.
Maybe, but so according to some media reports, they're saying that the president condemns, quote, all forms of violence, bigotry, and hatred, and of course that includes white supremacists, KKK, neo-Nazi, and all extremist groups. Also, I'm sure you can check out Donald Trump's tweets at his Real Donald
but
Trump.
But then you have to put the White House statement in the context of the history of Donald Trump and his statements on these matters. Okay, we're running out of time. We'll be back with more. But here's Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, American Girl, after these messages, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was American Girl by Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. Speaking of heartbreakers, Tan Chung Han.
Hey.
Myself, Sharad Kutin. With more, because we come back home from Charlottesville, long, long way away, to Shalom, which is not quite a trending topic globally, but it certainly is locally. And of course, We had a bit of violence there yesterday at the Nothing to Hide 2.0 rally, which, of course, was presided over by the former Prime Minister and now leader of Bersatu, and, of course, a major figure within the federal opposition, the Pakatan Harapan, Tun Dr. Mahathir Mohamad. Now, there was at this event... there was a flare that was set off, as well as, I believe, some projectiles. Partisan voices in that event say were actually aimed at Tun Mahathir. And very interesting because we rarely have, at least in the last couple of decades, serious and systemic violence when it comes to politics in this country. So any instance of violence really is, you know, cause for people to kind of sit up and take notice. Did you read of this yourself, Han?
Well, yeah, it populated my Facebook news feed, and I saw some video clips there of allegedly said projectiles, although the view from that shot, I couldn't really tell. You know, but it certainly runs contrary to what we have seen, you know, just recently with that relatively peaceful and successful conversation between DAP and MCA, right, recently. And also, of course, here on the Breakfast Grill, you know, we had that chat between an UMNO and PKR rep. So it shows that it is possible, but unfortunately, it appears to... I don't know. I think it tends to generate less attention versus these kind of violent episodes.
Well, you know, actually, if I think back a couple of years, I've seen a Harian, you know, as a group has tried to get those forum together, getting opposing sides. And I remember watching Kairi Jamaluddin debate Ambika Srinivasan, you know, over, you know, various issues. And huge numbers of people came. I mean, right. I'm talking about thousands of people came. And it's that kind of thing, right? If both sides are willing to come up and we had more of it, maybe we'll get used to it. Maybe right. there'd be, if you remember, you know, that Sri Anwar Ibrahim debating... and I'm trying to think of the UMNO minister now, Shabri Cheek, there it is. Thank you so much, producer, voiceless producer, pointing to his face there, Cheek. You know, and that was really good too, and because that's where the state broadcaster came in as honest broker, allowing and creating platforms for debates across these divides. Mm. But, you know, my fear is that, in fact, these are few and far between.
Right.
We'll end up counting the number of these instances on our fingers, and we don't develop a culture where we debate freely across divides.
Right. Because I recall early on when I first came back into the country, there was actually a debate between...
I don't know why they let you in.
Yeah, I know, right? There was a debate on air, on radio, between MCA and either Karakhan or... no, it can be Karakhan. MCA and DAP, I believe. It's been a while now. And that one just descended into a total, you know, circus. Like, it was just unintelligible shouting like on air, you know. And so when you have those kind of instances... I can see why those who are opposed to these kind of open forums and all those, you know, critics who might then say, you know, see, we're not quite ready yet, right? So obviously, but there's the will. Yeah, you know, we have to create this kind of environment where, you know, we almost... Make it the norm, right? Where we have these kind of open debates.
You know, the authoritarian argument always is that people are not ready, groups there are not, you know, won't be, you know, follow the rules, and therefore the state has to intervene, and the state has to be the arbiter. But in fact, you know, you're never going to be ready until you do it. I mean, it's a practice, right? A democracy is a practice. The more you do it, the more that people say, we don't want the slanging matches, and what we want is to hear intelligent debate, then, you know, those politicians will have to calm down because, after all, they're there to get people's votes, right? So so it's a practice, you know, and I think the authoritarian argument is so, you know, kind of worn that today we shouldn't actually even be repeating it.
So as we go about this agenda of trying to, you know, make sure that we make the political discourse more mature here in Malaysia, do we then risk more of these kind of instances?
Well, you know, that's a very good question. Tell us what you think. Tweet us at BFM Radio or WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. That's 018-789-8899. We're taking you all the way up to the news at 7 o'clock. Is Aretha Franklin with her song, very appropriate, Think, BFM 89.9. Good morning. I'm Sharad Kutun. Meet Tan Chung Han, and the morning run continues. So just past 6 minutes over after 7 in the morning, and it's the 14th of August. We're kind of mid-month August, because, you know, we're racing towards the end of the year. It feels, always feels that way, doesn't it, Han?
Not willingly, I guess.
No, but you know. We are merely, you know, pawns in the game of time. Oh. Okay, well, that's a bit of profundity for you. Now, 110,000 ringgit, that's how much Malaysian parents spend on average on their children's education, spanning primary to higher education. And this was according to a new HSBC report, which surveyed over 8,000 parents in 15 countries on around the world in a global education trends report. We spoke to Ira Azari, who's a researcher under the Social Policy Unit at the Institute of Democracy and Economic Affairs, and we asked her what the results of the survey say about parents' perception of the quality of education in Malaysia.
So, I mean, that's obviously a lot of money. We must remember that this includes education from primary school up to university undergraduate level. And I think it is a well-established fact that university education is expensive no matter where you go, except in certain countries like in Germany where it's completely free. But I think the worrying part here is the fact that it's from primary to secondary school, which signals that Malaysian parents are shifting from the national education system to private schools. So I think this signals a shift in trust between parents and the national education system, which is quite worrying, because if we are going to maintain the national education system as the national system that we want our children to be educated in, then if parents are not trusting it anymore and preferring to spend these enormous amounts of money in private education, then what does that tell you about our own education system, right? And I also believe that it is the parents' responsibility to pay for children's education. So if they can afford to spend this money on their child's education, then I don't think there's anything wrong in that per se. The question we have to look at is, what are they turning away from? So if they are turning away from our national education system, then I think that's worrying, because that shows our deteriorating education system.
We also asked her what it would take for Malaysian parents to consider a local higher education institution.
So I think the primary reason why parents choose to send their children abroad is, of course, firstly, is the quality of the education itself. And when we talk about quality of education, it's not just how courses are taught or what kind of courses are offered, but it's the entire environment of a university that parents take into consideration. So, for example, if the academic atmosphere of a university is compromised or is stifled, which is what has happened in our local public universities, then, of course, parents who afford it would choose to send their students abroad. So as long as laws in this country exist where students are not allowed to participate in politics or, you know, invite opposition leaders to come and speak in their university compound, or not allowed to go and observe elections as part of their course, for example, then I don't think students are getting the overall experience that university education is supposed to provide. So what will it take? I think it needs huge shift in how higher education in this country is done in the first place. And it would require the abolishing of laws, of legislation that stifle academic freedom, that stifle students' freedom. And autonomy should be given back to universities, where they are allowed to teach their own syllabus without having to go through numerous bureaucratic procedures. And lecturers are given the academic freedom to teach what they want to teach, and, of course, are not burdened by other administrative tasks. So, yeah, I think it really requires a big systemic change in the entire system.
That was Ira Azhari, a researcher under the Social Policy Unit of Ideas of the Institute of Democracy and Economic Affairs think tank that's based in Kuala Lumpur. I wonder, though, you know, when I listened to her talk about what puts parents off, and she talked about the atmosphere and the lack of academic freedom, and I'm wondering if that would be the first thing that I would point to. I think maybe with public universities in this country, the perception is that even on the intake level, there is no meritocracy. So the kids being recruited into these universities are not there on merit. Mm. That's one problem, I think. And also perhaps even the academic staff, that they have perhaps advanced and not on merit, but on either for racial reasons or for questions of loyalty to the ruling government. These would be perceptions, the negative perceptions that people would have of the institutions, right? So you have the quality of students that are going there and also the quality of staff that have risen up the ranks. Mm. And I think together that perhaps makes up the kind of bulk of the prejudice against public universities. Though I must say, you know, some of our public universities have produced excellent academics. You think of USM, that in fact used to be, you know, the home of the Aliran Group, a group of concerned academics that produced a monthly magazine that took on the government of the day, took on policies with a very critical eye to what was happening in the country. So, you know, USM for decades housed that group. So what is the true reality? What is the reality of our public universities?
Right. You know, so, and also if you're considering the merits of students who are entering the public universities, right? Well, one can also argue that that is subjective, because if you were to base it purely on academics, then you could see this widening gulf between those who are academically inclined versus, say, the broader student population, right? If the idea is to equipped more Malaysians, you know, especially those from diverse demographics, with a university education in order to better their life chances, then perhaps there has to be this kind of affirmative action, esque policy when it comes to recruiting students, right?
Well, maybe, you know, I mean, well, you know, if you look at
opposed to just straight A kids, that's it. Is that the only criteria?
Well, you know, but I don't know. I don't know if I think you want to have as your default mode meritocracy, so that the best kids come there. You might want to mix that up with all kinds of other policies, but that should be the majority rather than the minority. Mm. The other thing, of course, is the private universities in this country and private institutions of higher education, I don't think fare better when it comes to recruitment, because there the imperative is the commercial one.
Right.
It's the bums and seats imperative. Mm-hmm. And you see a real... having taught in some of these private universities and colleges, you know, you can see the real dumbing down. And, you know, there's a problem in our private institutions as well, where, you know, not only is it not the best who get in, but everybody is recruited, perhaps in people who are not fit for those courses. And that's very detrimental to the self-image and self-worth of those young people who get in who can't cope. It's kids who perhaps did a Chinese primary school, Malay, secondary school, and suddenly had to do English tertiary education.
Exactly.
And they're completely at a loss. And I feel their pain.
Right.
And that's another problem. On the flip side, never mind public universities, private universities have a whole set of problems themselves.
In fact, in about half an hour or so, we'll be discussing the plight of certain players in the private in the private sector, like those who are involved in private education, especially on the tertiary level here, because you essentially are dealing with the economics as well. Because, you know, many people thought that there was tremendous potential in that segment, they all jumped right in. And what we're finding out now, as we'll discover in about half an hour, is that many of them are not financially viable as well. In other words, they're not getting enough bums on seats. They may have overestimated the potential in that, in that segment. Whether or not that's a result of more parents choosing to send their kids overseas rather than keeping them here, be it in the public or private sector, we'll have to, I guess that's up for debate here.
I look forward to that discussion. You can join this conversation by tweeting us at BFM Radio or WhatsApping us at 018-789-8899. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.